The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Before the Supreme Court deemed sodomy laws unconstitutional in the United States, 56 years before it legalized abortion in Roe v. Wade, 52 years before California became the first state in the U.S. to implement a no-fault divorce law, 90 years before New York became the last. The revolutionary government of Russia decriminalized homosexuality, made abortion legal and free, made divorce accessible on demand, and gave people the right to change their sex on their passports, a right that transgendered people in the United States have only had since 2010. As the gaping chasm in political timelines between Russia and the rest of the world on these questions might suggest, these advances were not greeted with cheers in the American media. Headlines in the New York Times proclaimed, "Women are nationalized," or "Soviets make girls register at free love bureaus." Gross distortions of the Russian Revolution are, as people probably know, rampant in corporate media, popular culture, and in school history textbooks. And it's not by accident. The Russian Revolution shows us a glimpse of what a different world can look like, one in which society as a whole is committed to the eradication of all forms of oppression, not its perpetuation. And that is as terrifying to the capitalist class as it is inspiring to ours. To be clear, it's just a glimpse because even in revolutionary periods, oppression cannot just be phased out overnight. And faced with counter-revolution, war, scarcity, and the ultimate triumph of Stalinism, the most significant gains were short-lived. But in that glimpse, we can see what is possible when the masses of working people, upon whom laws and social policy are imposed under capitalism, are made the authors of a new world, as everything about society was re-examined and reimagined in light of human need and liberation. A revolution is, in Lenin's phrase, a festival of the oppressed. All revolutionary periods open up questions and debates when all that is old is questioned. This is certainly true in Russia, and I want to touch on the outpouring of ideas and explosions of debates that occur when ordinary people actually believe that what they think, say, or do can transform their lives, relationships, and world. But the Russian Revolution is the only example we have of a victorious workers' revolution in which the principles of socialism from below were in practice made the basis for a new society. In this regard, the Bolshevik approach to oppression was crucial, contributing, I will argue, to the party's success in the lead up to taking power and the political impetus for the most progressive policies and greatest gains of the revolution. This method is worth learning from to provide a model for activists and revolutionaries today. The far-reaching changes in social and political policies related to marriage, social reproduction, sexuality, education, language, and national self-determination were not in revolutionary Russia incidental to the revolution with Stalinist Russia correcting course, as some historians have argued. In fact, they were a direct result of the specific approach the Bolsheviks took to fighting oppression. The Bolsheviks argued for, and the lessons of the revolution bear out, an understanding of oppression as rooted in the material conditions and needs of capitalism. Thus, eradicating it requires a revolutionary transformation of society as a whole. This was the project the Bolsheviks undertook in the revolution, but as I'll talk about more at the end, the material conditions of civil war and counter-revolution were, in the absence of worldwide socialist revolutions, limitations that proved insurmountable. I'll try, sorry, I tend to talk too fast. I'll do my best. The resulting triumph of Stalin, though, and the negation of the promise of the revolution that that entailed does not, I would argue, take away from the revolution's historic importance as the highest stage of liberation the working class has achieved. Rather, it compels us to learn the lessons of that history and put them into practice today. There's a prevalent caricature of Marxism that privileges the economic over all else and thus sees only class when it comes to questions of social inequality, either ignoring or minimizing oppressions based on race, class, gender, sexuality, ability, and other identity-based oppressions. The Marxist tradition, however, tells a very different story. Marx wrote that capital comes dripping from head to foot from every pore with blood and dirt, arguing that, quote, "the veiled slavery of the wage workers in Europe needed for its pedestal, slavery pure and simple in the New World," and argued that labor in white skin can never be free as long as labor in black skin is branded. He advocated for siding unequivocally with the Irish in the struggle for national liberation, with the Union against the slaveholding Confederacy in the U.S. Civil War, and with Indians against British colonial rule. With his collaborator Engels, he wrote about the specific oppression of women in the family and in the workplace, and argued for the abolition of the family and privatized reproduction and for full equality for women. Central to Marxism is the idea that oppression and class exploitation are linked, that a socialist society cannot be achieved unless the working class movement is united on the basis of ending all forms of oppression and exploitation. Lenin drew on this tradition in arguing against the class reductionism of his day. What is to be done, written in 1902, is in fact a polemic against class reductionism, or as it was called then, economism. It's worth noting that the title itself was taken from a widely read novel at the time by Nikolai Chernyevsky about a woman who emancipates herself from the family through economic independence. In this text, Lenin polemicizes against a tendency to see purely economic struggles as the only way to unite workers on a class basis. And this, for Lenin, is the consciousness of what he calls the trade union bureaucrat. Something that will be familiar to any of you in unions who have been told at some point that movements like Black Lives Matter, the anti-war movement, or even the Women's March are somehow divisive, and we should focus on the working conditions that can unite our members. The socialist revolutionary needs a political consciousness that goes beyond the economic, Lenin argues, to become what he refers to as the social democratic consciousness. He explains, and I'm going to read this, it's a long quote, but I think it's an important one. He says, working class consciousness cannot be genuine political consciousness unless the workers are trained to respond to all cases of tyranny, oppression, violence, and abuse, no matter what class is affected. For this reason, the conception of the economic struggle as the most widely applicable means of drawing the masses into the political movement, which our economists preach, is extremely harmful and reactionary. The social democrat's ideal should not be the trade union secretary, but the tribune of the people who is able to react to every manifestation of tyranny and oppression, no matter where it appears, no matter what stratum or class of the people it affects, who is able to generalize all these manifestations and produce a single picture of police violence and capitalist exploitation in order to clarify for all and everyone the world historic significance of the struggle for the emancipation of the proletariat. Hardly the kind of class reductionist Lenin we hear so much about. In the decades leading up to the Russian Revolution, debates about oppression played an important role in the development of Lenin's political thought and the Bolshevik Party as a whole, as well as socialists internationally. In 1903, revolutionaries debated the Jewish question in response to both the immense anti-Semitism of Tsarist Russia, in which pogroms proliferated, as well as demands by the Bund, an organization of Jewish socialists, to be the sole organizing body for Jewish workers. I don't have time to get into the details of this very important debate, but I think it's worth noting that one key aspect of Lenin and Trotsky's position at the time is worth emphasizing, that the fight against oppression, despite being led by the oppressed themselves, is the task of the Revolutionary Party as a whole, who must win the entire working class to this vision of solidarity, not just those who are directly experiencing this oppression. While Jewish workers and students organized themselves in armed self-defense groups, Russian Marxists, usually in alliance with the Bund, were consistent fighters against the pogromists. In fact, Tsarist officials and reactionary forces sought to direct anti-Semitic violence against the entire revolutionary movement, which they claimed was led and controlled by Jews. In this context, combating pogroms became a necessity of self-defense for the socialist movement as a whole. An upturn in national movements during and following 1905, the revolution then, as well as the experience of World War I, in which Second International leaders in Europe capitulated to ruling class nationalist war drives, provoked increased debate on the national question and led to changing ideas about national liberation and self-determination for oppressed nations. Lenin explained that the oppression of non-Russians is what he called a stick with two ends, one which beats the non-Russian and the other the Russian people. While the Lenin and the Bolsheviks' approach to national liberation evolved through political practice over many years, from this time they were committed to the right to self-determination for oppressed nationalities, including the right to secede. Lenin explained in July 1916, he said, "It is impossible to abolish national or any other political oppression under capitalism, since this requires the abolition of classes, i.e. the introduction of socialism. But while being based on economics, socialism cannot be reduced to economics alone. By transforming capitalism into socialism, the proletariat creates the possibility of abolishing national oppression. The possibility becomes reality only, he repeats only with an exclamation point again, with the establishment of full democracy in all spheres, including the delineation of state frontiers, in accordance with the sympathies of the population, including complete freedom to secede. And this in turn will serve as the basis for developing the practical elimination of even the slightest national friction and the least national mistrust for an accelerated drawing together and fusion of nations that will be completed when the state withers away. This is the Marxist theory. As mentioned previously, Marxism has a long tradition of political thought about, as well as active involvement in, the fight against women's oppression. While Marx and Engels laid the foundation, later socialists contributed to the development of this body of political thought and had a profound influence on the women who were crucial to the victory of the Russian Revolution. I'm not going to talk about this much here, but I'll just say a little bit in terms of the debates of in revolutionary Russia. But the pre-history of Bolshevik engagement with the women question is worth briefly highlighting. There was a history of women active in political organizing in Russia in the late 19th century, including many who were revolutionaries, some involved in terrorist groups, others who joined social democratic study circles and participated in efforts to bring political education to workers. Many of them had read the previously mentioned What Is to Be Done, as well as Engels and August Bebel's Women in Socialism, which was influential among many of the women in the revolution. The work of Clara Zetkin, the German Marxist, who was also widely read, as was the work of Alexandra Kollontai, who's perhaps the most famous woman Bolshevik revolutionary, who played an incredibly important role in mobilizing women workers, a growing militant force within the Russian working class. At the same time, Kollontai participated in wider feminist formations where she argued for a class-based approach to the question of women's liberation, seeking not only equality in the existing framework, but a transformation of society. While the Bolsheviks shared the goal of universal suffrage and greater access to education and formal equality with some of the other feminists, Kollontai's socialist politics frequently and increasingly put her at odds with some of the liberal feminists of her day, many of whom saw feminism as kind of primarily a philanthropic venture, and increasingly the gap grew as later they mobilized women to support the war effort. In 1914, the Bolsheviks set up a journal titled The Woman Worker, or Ravnitsa, edited by Inessa Armand and Nadezhda Krupskaya, which was short-lived at the time and brought back post-revolution, but gives some sense of the commitment the Bolsheviks had to organizing women workers. All of these debates, I think, on the Jewish question, national question, and women question, were magnified a millionfold by the events of the revolution itself. But I think it's important to say that these were the politics of the Bolsheviks leading up to the revolution, and that was partly why they were able to be successful and count among its leaders Jews, women, gay men, workers from many national and ethnic origins. And it's also worth noting that the revolution began with an uprising of women on International Women's Day, as women who had been organizing in factories, particularly in the textile industry, and on bread lines, and by the time of the revolution, even the Tsarist police had recognized their potential power, calling them, quote, a mass of inflammable material which needs only a spark for it to burst into flames. And burst into flames they did, as a strike of 90,000 led by women workers was joined by 1,000 more women who were standing in bread lines and who convinced the soldiers to put down their guns and join the side of the revolution, eventually forcing the Tsar to abdicate. And this is kind of, it's a huge topic, so I feel like there's a little bit of like a kind of greatest hits of other talks, so people really should leave this and also listen to other talks. There was a great talk last year by Leah and Dana on women in the Russian Revolution. Trotsky describes the revolution as follows. He says that it was a revolution begun from below, overcoming the resistance of its own revolutionary organizations, the initiative being taken of their own accord by the most oppressed and downtrodden part of the proletariat, the women textile workers, and among them, no doubt, many soldiers' wives. In the aftermath of the October Revolution, when the Bolsheviks came to power, revolutionaries sought to put into practice the approach to fighting and ending oppression that they'd honed in theory in debates over the previous decades. And the first few years of the Russian Revolution saw an unprecedented flourishing of radical ideas and profound social, political, and legal changes that transformed working class life, particularly the lives of the oppressed. And again, this is a very huge topic, so I'm going to mention a bunch of different things, but there's several other talks and people should listen to and articles you read. Dana and Leah's talk I mentioned also. There's a great talk by Jason Janowitz on sex and sexuality in the revolution. And Keith Rosenthal's done some really great work on disability in the Russian Revolution, which I'm just going to kind of do a few highlights of, but I can't go into as much detail. Weeks after seizing power, though, homosexuality was decriminalized, church weddings were no longer recognized, and divorce granted to one party without explanation so that entering a marriage or leaving one became, according to one newspaper article, a matter of shuffling paper. It's worth noting that previously, just to give a sense, women were not even allowed to move within Russia without their husbands, and divorces were only allowed based on impotence or adultery. And in the case of adultery, you needed two witnesses to that, because who doesn't bring witnesses with them? And if granted, the offending party was never allowed to marry again. In addition to this, full equality was before the law was granted to all people, men and women, at a time when no capitalist country in the world did the same. Only a week after the October Revolution, the Soviet government decreed the equality and sovereignty of the peoples of Russia and the right of these peoples to self-determination up to and including independence. Soviet legislation declared the absolute non-involvement of the state and society in sexual relations, provided they harm no one and infringe upon no one's interests. Sexual harassment of women was outlawed in Russia, and in Uzbekistan, where prior to the revolution, male prostitution had been common, similar legislation protected men from sexual harassment. Abortion was legalized and made free. Illegitimacy was no longer a category, ensuring that all children would be provided for regardless of the relationship status of the parents. In fact, in at least one case where paternity could not be ascertained, child support was to be paid by all men with whom the mother had sexual relations, just in case. Later, cohabitation or de facto marriages were given legal recognition and campaigns of sexual education were implemented. Whereas before the revolution, women in the city worked long hours for less pay than men, hiding pregnancies because they could be fired as a result, the Bolsheviks set up the Department for the Protection of Motherhood and Infancy in January 1918 that was closely connected with the Department of Social Welfare. Paid maternity leave for 8 weeks before and 8 weeks after birth was instituted, and new laws prevented expectant mothers from being fired. Night work was prohibited for pregnant and nursing mothers. Maternity homes, clinics, and advisory centers were also set up. All around Russia, new schools and universities were created, mass literacy campaigns conducted, and literature was produced in mass to meet the thirst for knowledge. Schools were coeducational to combat segregation of the sexes and fed children. Kindergartens, daycares, and preschools were also created, both to free women from childcare responsibilities and to provide progressive education to children. I'm going to focus on the lesbian. I'm going to focus a lot on kind of the women questions. I think it's one of the more important ones. The Bolshevik vision of ending women's oppression centered on a few key precepts: free union, women's emancipation through wage labor, the socialization of housework, and the withering away of the family. Changes in marriage and family laws were crucial to this vision. The New York Times reported in February 18 that as soon as divorce was legalized, and they were not happy about this, but 38,000 applications were made in Petrograd alone, with one appointed minister processing some 500 to 600 applications per week. Not celebrated in the paper record, but I think it's worth emphasizing how transformative and liberating these laws could be for working women. In rural areas, in particular, women prior to the revolution lived in semi-feudal situations. As one proverb explained, a chicken is not a bird, and a baba, which was the word for a peasant woman, is not a human being. In peasant families, it was customary for the bride's father to give the groom a new whip so he could exercise his authority if he wished. Popular songs frequently sung for courtship to give expression to the, give some expression to the transformation of women's lives as a result of the new family laws. Whereas pre-revolution, most of these songs kind of lament the experience of being sold into marriage unwillingly and being separated from one's parents, the new songs appeared that went as follows. I'm going to read a couple of those, they're just great. One was, "Time was when my husband used his fists and force, but now he is so tender for he fears divorce." Or, "It used to be girls were afraid to love the young lads, but now the young men are afraid to have to pay child support." Or I think in an expression even beyond that of new worlds opened up for women beyond marriage and the family, there's one, "My cambric kerchief smells of politics. Tomorrow when I give a talk, the public will ooh and ah." New land and family laws gave a new measure of protection to the unmarried, the outcast, and the landless. One story that struck me is the story of Matrina Melnikova, who was a poor laborer who had worked since childhood, only to be thrown out of the divorce. In the rural communities, the household was also a unit of production, so they were where the work happened. So she was thrown out by her husband after the death of her child. Prior to the revolution, she would have had no recourse. But appearing before the new courts, she explained, "I heard in the village that now there was this law that they could no longer insult a woman this way." The courts awarded her 4,000 pounds of wheat, a horse, a cow, and 6 sheep to be given to her by her husband's family. And I think her case was unusual because in most cases, her husband's family had more money than others, but it gives a sense of just how transformative this was. And this is people who weren't necessarily active revolutionaries. A 1926 article from The Atlantic decries the increase in divorce and abortions, saying it was not an unusual occurrence for a girl of the same age to have had 3 or 4 abortions. As the peasants of one town bitterly complained, abortions cover our villages with shame. Formerly, we did not even hear of them. But the women, in self-defense, replied, it's easy for you to talk, but if you tried to bear children yourselves, you would sing a different song. And it's worth saying that this is despite the fact that the procedure itself was done frequently without anesthetic and was incredibly painful. And yet there were so many women who wanted them that they had to institute a formal policy of prioritizing access. While it was free, women workers got priority. Formerly bourgeois women were at the bottom of the list. In fact, the Bolsheviks did not actually have an understanding of reproductive freedom and control over one's own body as essential to women's liberation. They saw abortion really as a kind of necessary evil. And here in other places, I think theory lags some behind practice. Maybe we can talk more about that in the discussion. Nonetheless, throughout Russia, women were emboldened by the revolution and organized to end their own oppression. In one town, there's a letter that was written to all the citizens of the village of Vertyevka, of the male sex who are married, from all the citizens of the village of Vertyevka, of the female sex who are married, with the title just ultimatum. And they wrote, whereas all we married women, citizens of the village, live under difficult conditions, our husbands beat us, we hear no decent words from them, they treat us like cattle, and therefore we have no more patience to endure such insults, and we hereby write the present ultimatum. We agree to work at home and be our husbands' helpers, but demand in return that we shall not be given over completely to our husbands' wills, that they shall not be so free with their hands and call us such names as old hag, bitch, slut, and other unmentionable ones. And this too, we add, we shall not disperse and not return to our husbands until they have all signed their names on this paper. And I think as the above, these kind of examples make clear, women were not passive spectators in the fight to end their own oppression. In 1918, over 1,000 women, mostly workers, attended the first all-Russian Congress of Working Women, where Kollontai and Lenin spoke on women's oppression, the family, and the state. It's worth, as a side note, Kollontai had requested a room for a meeting of 300 people. The party said, we'll give you one that fits 80, and over 1,000 people showed up. Out of these conferences, new women's commissions were created to instruct women on their rights. In 1919, this became the Genetdel, a department specifically tasked with organizing women to bring them into political activity, mobilizing against famine, and participating in the Civil War, some even in the Red Army. They had a train that was specifically dedicated to the Genetdel for this use, and this is in the middle of incredible scarcity, so the resources devoted are important. They used a wide range of agitprop, art, performance to spread their message, setting up over 125,000 literacy schools, which was a crucial task in a country where in 1913, for example, the literacy rate for female workers was only 33%. There were also courses to train women to become nurses, teachers, and central to these campaigns was a priority on political literacy. There's a great long description of a political literacy course for red nurses, which goes through a whole list of terms that they should know and political concepts, as well as then the example of how to lead a meeting and run one. And it concludes with this, though. The main goal is to awaken interest in political issues in general and the students' ability to move from the coincidental facts of everyday life to generalizations. The Genetdel produced a monthly magazine and a wide range of publications on everything from socialized childcare to Soviet architects' designs for new homes to take into account plans for communal facilities. As one historian says, there has probably never been a time when great masses of people discussed openly questions which affected women so much. Perhaps the most difficult question was how to go beyond legislation to liberate women in the household via communal kitchens, cooperative play groups, and improve women's working conditions in a time of famine, war, and scarcity. As Trotsky made clear, this was essential to women's liberation. He wrote, unless there is actual equality of husband and wife in the family, in a normal sense, as well as the conditions of life, we cannot speak seriously of their equality in social work or even in politics. As long as woman is chained to her housework, the care of the family, the cooking and sewing, all her chances of participation in social and political life are cut down to the extreme. And for Trotsky, the Revolutionary Party played a key role in this project. Party quotes from a letter from a comrade discussing a meeting he'd had with neighbors about how to reorganize their community to create communal kitchens, schools, playgrounds, and everybody was coming up with ideas. And the women complained that the men weren't listening to them enough. And he concludes this anecdote with two lessons. One, he says, It is well to have the problems of life grounded by the grinders of collective proletarian thought. The grinders are strong and will master anything they are given to grind. And then he ends, though, with the words of women. Quoting them, he says, "You only think about yourselves," said the woman to Comrade Karchevsky, "and you have no thought for us." He says, continues, "It's quite true," he says, "that there are no limits to masculine egotism in ordinary life. In order to change the conditions of life, we must learn to see them through the eyes of women." Perhaps no issue produced more debate in the aftermath of revolution than the one we would expect to dominate in the midst of war, famine, and counter-revolution, which is, of course, sex. As Engels notes, it's a curious fact that with every great revolutionary movement, the question of free love comes to the foreground. And one observer noted in the Russian Revolution that outside of the revolution itself, no subject commands as much attention as does sex. A survey conducted on sexual behavior in 1922 had over 1,500 Moscow students respond and gives a fascinating view of attitudes towards sexuality among post-revolutionary youth. Only 14.3% of women, compared to 20-something percent of men, cited marriage as their ideal. One woman explained, "I don't want to be subordinate to a husband or become his slave," and therefore she wrote she preferred short-term romantic liaisons. Another woman explained, "Sex, I'm afraid, plays the major role in my life. It usually doesn't interfere with my work, but that's a big struggle." One 22-year-old student came up with a unique, if somewhat utilitarian, approach to sex in revolutionary Russia, proposing that they build intercourse wards modeled after maternity wards, and concludes, "If necessary, I can give you a fully detailed account of this idea." And I mention this not because this had great traction or it's a good idea necessarily, but I think it shows something about the period that he has a fully detailed account of his proposal ready to go should anybody want to implement it. Debates about sexuality, particularly in the Komsomol, the youth organizations, poured into the pages of Pravda. After one letter was published portraying a negative depiction of sexuality among youth, in which male worker students felt entitled to sex, whereas women students sometimes worried that they would be called bourgeois if they refused, the newspaper published 16 columns of readers' letters in response to that. And frequently, in most of these debates, actually many of the party officials didn't weigh in the pages of Pravda, but it's worth saying that there were debates about sexuality among the kind of upper echelons of the party as well, most notably between Alexandra Kollontai and Lenin. Kollontai is undoubtedly the most important writer on sexuality in this period, and if people haven't read her writings, they really should. They're all available online. She developed an idea of love comradeship based on equality, mutual recognition of rights, and comrade sensitivity. Her essay on Winged Eros, directed to the working youth, attempted to both theorize the current state of sexual relations in Russia in the midst of civil war, while also positing a vision of human relationships and sexuality that would be the fullest expression of a democratic society based on equality, solidarity, and human liberation. At the same time, she argued very strongly against moralizing about sexuality, arguing, quote, that the sexual act must be seen not as something shameful and sinful, but as something which is natural as the other needs of a healthy organism, such as hunger or thirst. Such phenomena cannot be judged as moral or immoral. Despite their close collaboration, Lenin and Kollontai, they did diverge on some of this issue. In an interview with Clara Zetkin, Lenin argued in response to Kollontai that yes, thirst has to be quenched, but he writes, "But would a normal person lie down in the gutter and drink from a puddle?" He also expressed some impatience with the sexual revolution of the communist youth, noting that the revolution demands concentration. It cannot tolerate orgiastic conditions. And so I think on the one hand, these comments reflect a generation gap between some of the older Bolsheviks and the revolutionary youth. It, you know, was a revolution of youth in many ways. There were also real concerns that the new sexual relations could, in some cases, not be as liberatory for women, particularly in a world where abortion was the second most common form of birth control after coitus interruptus, which people, I'm sure, know does not have a good record. While there were debates about sexuality, Soviet policy was the most liberatory policy that existed anywhere at the time, based on the fundamental notion that neither the state nor church had any business regulating sexuality between consenting adults. The decriminalization of homosexuality was a crucial aspect of this. And same-sex marriages were allowed in at least some cases. At the same time, I think, and this is another topic that could come up in the discussion, it's worth notice that the language used to discuss same-sex love and desire was limited, as was the Bolsheviks' understanding of gender. Thus, often gender nonconforming people were kind of considered part of what they called the intermediate sex. I think despite a lot of these limitations, again, where I think sometimes theory lagged behind practice, Russia enjoyed a degree of sexual liberation that didn't exist anywhere else. And it perhaps most inspiring, I think, is what it allowed people to imagine, even if unrealizable in the present. Kollontai, in her letter to youth, writes about the future she imagines and writes, "The task of proletarian ideology is not to drive Eros from social life, but to rearm him according to the new social formation and to educate sexual relationships in the spirit of the great new psychological force of comradely solidarity." The fight against oppression after the 1917 revolution was not limited to these questions. The question of national self-determination and oppressed minorities is that it was a crucial in a country where oppressed peoples made up the majority of the pre-1917 Tsarist empire. As I mentioned before, secession, the right to self-determination, including secession, was granted immediately to all oppressed or minority groups. Each nation within Russia was invited to decide democratically whether or not to participate in the federal structure. National minorities were given autonomy over language, education, and culture. And this meant, for example, in Muslim territories, they determined their own legal system. I want to say something just very briefly about language, partly because I think there's a tendency to think that no one theorized questions of language before postmodernism, but also because in a nation with over 150 languages, self-determination in this domain was no small endeavor. As early as 1914, Lenin argued that while having a universal language to allow the fullest amount of communication and participation was desirable, this could not be done by coercion, and thus it was essential to fight for national autonomy. In October 1918, the general policy was established to provide for native language education in any school where 25 or more students in each age group spoke the same language. Nativizing or indigenizing language and literacy for populations in the Caucasus and Central Asian regions of the old empire was incredibly complicated. It meant, in some cases, actually creating written languages and scripts at all for languages that hadn't been written, that were only spoken. I think a key indication of this is just the number of languages in which textbooks were published, which grew from 25 in 1924 to 34 in 1925 to 44 in 1927. In response to information, at one point, that all Soviets in Turkestan used the Russian language, Lenin responded, quote, "All our talk of Soviet power will be hollow so long as the toilers of Turkestan do not speak in the native language in their institutions. Soviet power differs from every bourgeois and monarchical power in that it represents the real daily interests of the laboring masses in full measure. But that is not possible on the condition that is only possible on the condition that Soviet institutions work in native languages." There are many more examples of the oppressed organizing in revolutionary Russia. People should read Keith Rosenthal's two-part series on disability in the Russian Revolution, but it's worth noting briefly here that there was an all-Russian cooperative of disabled people known as VIKO, all-Russian Union of the Blind, and all-Russian Union of the Deaf, which were established in 1921, 1923, and 1926, respectively. Within VIKO, only people with disabilities had voting power, and all decisions were made democratically. The Soviet government also became one of the first in the world to make the universal education of children with disabilities a matter of public policy administered through the state. Prominent Marxist education and psychology theorist Vygotsky reframed the entire question of disability as a social question, arguing that it is the social ramifications a disability has for a child, not the disability itself, that creates difficulties, and thus, in a socialist society, these needs should not be debilitating. Here, too, the oppressed would take the lead, as Vygotsky's vision of education included the self-organization and democratic decision-making of children. In all of these, I think there's a couple common threads that I want to highlight. First is that while the struggle against oppression is invariably led by the oppressed themselves, it must be the project of the working class as a whole. Two, the right to self-determination for the oppressed is crucial to the project of building working class unity and internationalism. It provides the political basis for real solidarity. And lastly, the fight against oppression is not just ideological. Although this was very important, which you can see from the political literacy campaigns, the immense amount of publications, etc., since oppression has material roots, its eradication also needs to address the material conditions which produce it, which requires a restructuring of society as a whole. Thus, to liberate women from the drudgery of housework, it's not enough to get men to do more of it. Even if that's a good thing. Instead, housework must be collectivized through communal projects to make it a social burden and not an individual one. These lessons were not limited to Bolshevik Russia, but were generalized by the left internationally via the Communist International, founded in March 1919. An American delegate to the conference, Claude McKay, was particularly struck by one passage that announced, quote, "Colonial slaves of Africa and Asia, the hour of proletarian dictatorship in Europe will also be the hour of your liberation." the 1920 Congress, theses on national and colonial questions, generalized the approach and made active support for colonial liberation became a precondition for membership. It also pushed the American Communist Party to take up the specific fight against oppression of blacks in the United States, which up to that point it had been reluctant to do, seeing it as more of an economic problem to be fought through the general struggle of workers against capitalism. Two American delegates in 1922, including Claude McKay, drafted theses on the black questions, including a resolution that stated that the international should support every black movement that undermines or weakens capitalism or places barriers in the path of further expansion, that struggles for the equality of the white and black races and for equal wages and equal political and social rights would be supported. It would oppose the color bar and trade unions and take immediate steps to convene a general conference of blacks in Moscow. So it played a huge role in reorienting the U.S. Communist Party around this question. There was also a Communist Women's International, which had over 100,000 members and published a monthly journal to help generalize these lessons. And I think the commitment to internationalism of the Comintern is captured by Lenin's endorsement of a modification of the famous slogan by Marx and Engels. It was changed to "Workers of the World and Oppressed Peoples Unite." I'm going to conclude by saying a little bit on the material limitations. I think back to the idea that you have to transform the material conditions to end oppression, and there was huge efforts to do this, as can be seen in the kind of schools, communal kitchens, and all the rest of it. But in a country that was devastated by famine and a counter revolutionary offensive, the resources more often than not were simply not there. Schools struggled just to feed children and keep them warm and provide basic supplies. In one example, in 1920, there was a memo that said there was only one pencil allotted for 60 students. It's hard to get your head around the scale of the famine in the Volga region in 1921. It led to the death of 90 to 95% of children under three, and almost a third of those older. Children's homes were established, which tells over 500,000 by 1921, but the state was only able to distribute 10 inches of cloth per child. There was a single spool of thread for 29 people and one blanket for over 3,000. By 1922, there was an estimated 7.5 million starving and dying children in Russia. And I think in these conditions, there simply was not the material basis for the state to socialize childcare. By 1926, revisions to marriage laws provoked huge debate, in part because while the ease of divorce had been liberatory for women, it also led to concern of growing numbers of women who had been left by husbands and had to support children. While there were great laws, they often could not be enforced because people simply didn't have the money. So you couldn't actually kind of separate the question of free unions and sexual liberation and free love from the material conditions upon which people depended. And this was even more stark in rural areas where these laws ran up against the fact that the primary unit of production still was the home and family. And so these are the conditions in which Stalin rose to power, only to negate everything the revolution stood for. Abortion was recriminalized in 1936 at the same time as divorce laws were more difficult and more expensive. Anti-sodomy laws were reinstituted starting in 1933, and the Genadel disbanded in 1930. And I hate to kind of end with the downer of the history, but I think it's important because I think there's a tendency in mainstream history to the Russian Revolution to read its failures and the triumph of Stalinism back in time to its beginnings. And I think to do so misses the immense creativity, innovation, and debate unleashed by the revolution. The British writer and journalist Arthur Ransom put it well when he wrote of the Russian Revolution in 1918. He wrote, "It is possible that the revolution will fail. If so, then its failure will not mean that it loses its importance. If only in America, in England, in France, in Germany, people know why it has failed, who betrayed it, who murdered it. Man does not live by his deeds so much as the purpose of his deeds. We have seen the flight of the young eagles. Nothing can destroy that fact, even if later in the day the eagles fall to earth one by one with broken wings." And I think for us today, as we leave this conference and return to bring the lessons of the revolution, the lessons of this conference back to our unions, our schools, our neighborhoods, and our social movements, it's crucial that we bring the revolutionary tradition of the fight against oppression and for the self-emancipation of the working class back to our work. And I think that when we look at the kind of view that Ransom puts forward, it's a reminder to all of us that the Russian Revolution is not simply a part of a past in our history, but it's part of a future that we fight for. And to do that and to learn from its lessons means rescuing the legacy of revolutionaries as the tribune of the people and the oppressed from the caricatures and historical distortions, and bring that back into the movements for social justice today.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.